Welcome to a podcast from the Irish Linen Centre and Lisburn Museum. Today we're speaking to Dr. Sarah Doherty and her work on everyday life in ancient Egypt. I suppose we should really introduce ourselves. I'm Kieran Toll. I'm from the Irish Linen Centre and Lisburn Museum, and you are?
I'm Sarah Doherty. I work at in various places, but I work at the University of Oxford, and I'm a lecturer at the Egypt Exploration Society. And I also, my main job really is I work in developer-led archaeology for Chronicle Heritage, mostly in the Middle East.
So what does that involve? Like,
so it's exactly how it would be here in Northern Ireland, where if you want to change a museum, build a hotel, look at, you know, you're wanting to expand and do a housing development, everything needs to be checked for archaeology in advance of that. It's just part of the planning process, in the same way that you would check for great crested newts, veteran trees, if there's any weird and wonderful chemicals in the ground. All of those things have to get permits for, and archaeology is the exact same thing. So I write very nerdy reports that nobody really reads, that are called heritage impact assessments.
I'm sure somebody appreciates them.
You know, it pays the bills, generally speaking. But basically it looks at what archaeology is there, what are they wanting to do to the site or study area, and what impact would that have upon the archaeology? In lots of cases, that means total destruction. Because if you're building a hotel, you tend to be digging down into the ground, building your foundations and all that. But I also look for ways to do mitigation. So that might be moving the hotel out of the way of an area that we know is archaeologically sensitive. So say if we know there's a medieval cemetery there, or we know that there's remains of an ancient chapel or something like that, then we might go, no, this, or we might say, actually, it's too archaeologically important and we don't want this hotel to be built there at all. And we look at other places that it might be possible to do.
And you've had success with that? That's worked?
Yes, it does work. Cool. And it's very much a dialogue with the client. And also the local authority. So, you know, that might be Lisburn Council, for example, you know, or it might be wherever. So at the moment, I work a lot in Saudi Arabia, and they're very much working on that very same model, where they want to know what the archaeology is there. So my company's doing the first surveys, if you like, of parts of Saudi Arabia that's never happened before.
Wow.
And then once we get that lovely data, we nerds love a bit of data and lots of mapping that on, you know, computers everywhere. Then I then look at that data and analyze it and say, right, what's there? Is it important? Do we need to do some excavation there before to find out what's there? And if so, we go ahead and do that. And luckily the developer pays for that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. sort of begs the question, how do you get into that?
Like, how do you get into
that? What's your career path so far? I think it's probably fairly evident on the podcast so far that your accent is local.
I'm very, yes, I've kept it. But actually, I've most of my adult life, I have worked in England or in Wales, or I've studied there. So I started off studying at Belfast High School and had some great teachers there, and who kind of, I was always very interested in archaeology. I kind of was one of those weird people that knew what I wanted to do from like age 11.
Very strange, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's, I think it's still in the school curriculum, but at P5, you study ancient Egypt and Rome and stuff like that. There's this weird idea that in primary school, you study the Stone Age right the way through to the Roman period, and then you're kind of done with that. And then in high school, you move on to medieval period and you spend most of your time in history classes studying World War II, 1 and 2. It's very odd. But anyway, in primary school, that was, I got hooked by ancient Egypt at about age 11. And then I kind of saw that there was nowhere in Northern Ireland or even the South that I could study that. So I had to go to England, and I managed to get into University College London and studied there for 3 years, really enjoyed it, stayed there for another year and did my master's. And then I kind of wanted to do more. And I got really interested in archaeological ceramics in particular, and Egyptian ceramics, because they really put the people back into our understanding of the past. So even today, everybody has a cup, or where they have their tea or their coffee in the morning. We still eat off of ceramic plates mostly. And the same is true in the past. And we all, you know, that kind of brings that idea of culture, society, what we're eating, how we're eating it. Are we eating it communally? Mm-hmm. Yeah, are we eating it separately in our bedrooms, watching YouTube? You know, quite the way that we are eating and drinking today has changed quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And the same is true in the past. So if you think about our grandparents, for example, they might have had their tea in a cup and saucer. Whereas we're very unlikely to have it that way. We would mostly now have our keep cups or our Stanley cups. Mm-hmm. And the way we are having our beverages have changed quite dramatically in the past 50 to 80 years, I want to say. And it's exact, and I was sort of saying it was the exact same thing in ancient Egypt.
There's sort of like a window into how people were living, like cups.
Absolutely that.
Yeah.
It just sort of started that. And then I was like, so how are they making those cups?
Yeah, okay.
What is the process there? And you know, looking in the Industrial Revolution, they fundamentally changed how we eat or, you know, use our cups and saucers, for example, because they are poured, they use liquid clay, and they pour them now into a large sort of mold, and you can make thousands of the exact same cup and saucer. They're absolutely identical, but the skill is the person who makes the mold, not the person who pours the liquid clay in.
Yeah.
Anybody can do that. So what were they doing in the past before they made these molds were designed? Was it the potter's wheel, or was it something else before that? And that sort of got me thinking. Mm-hmm. And my PhD ended up being about the potter's wheel and its invention and its use.
Yeah,
I'm also very lucky that my uncle, Jack Docherty, is a very famous potter in his own right.
Okay.
He's from Portrush originally, and now makes the most fabulous porcelain bowls and other items. And I was able to sort of study his process.
Oh, well, that's useful. Yeah. Okay.
And understand how he makes, and then that then allowed me to undertake my own experimental reconstructions of the types of vessels that I was seeing in the archaeological record, to try and reconstruct those ancient hands and how they were working and making.
Oh, wow, okay.
So that's kind of how I sort of the process there. But as is often the case, once I finished my PhD, I did do a little bit of academic work, and I worked in various excavations. I worked for the British Museum for a while, and was lucky enough to dig in Sudan at an Egyptian colony site called Amara West, that was inhabited around 1300 BC for about 200 years. And I excavated a couple of houses that was part of this town. And that kind of kept me going for a little while, but I kind of realized that I wasn't going to get a lectureship role because there weren't many out there. So I then worked for a charitable foundation for a little while, which promoted mutual understanding between the Middle East and the West. So I was able to use my work in Egypt and Sudan a bit.
Okay.
I was doing a lot of events and sort of programming a lot of events as part of that. And then from then I got a job at the Ashmolean Museum in the public engagement department, where I programmed the public programming there. And I particularly programmed the museum lates, which are essentially big kind of festival late nights where we open up the museum after hours under a theme. And I brought in loads of different people, musicians, artists, archaeologists like myself, but also academics all across the University of Oxford, and got them to showcase the amazing research that's going on and seeing how they were inspired by the museum collections. And then unfortunately the pandemic happened and I was made redundant from that. And so then I moved into commercial archaeology. So using my skills as an archaeological excavator, And also during my PhD, I got quite interested in ancient buildings and how they were being built and constructed through my excavations in Sudan, but also while I did my PhD at Cardiff University, I worked a lot in Wales on 16th century manorial houses and things like that.
Yeah,
that
very varied work then,
You just get involved with whatever is going on.
Yeah.
And I also, so that kind of led me into developer-led archaeology, mostly in Oxfordshire. And I met my husband at the same kind of time. We were both working at Oxford, and so he's a research scientist, so he's not a humanities person, so he doesn't understand what I do.
Right.
I don't understand what he does, so it's quite good.
Yeah, it works quite well. I was reading an article about you from around 2014, 2015. This may have been that Aswan site you're referring to.
Yes.
And it was about, if I have this right, it was about the people who ended up building large monuments, such as possibly the pyramids. I'm not really sure. Did I get the wrong end of the stick?
I think that's a different site, actually. That's in Egypt. I didn't get to mention that one. It's called it's a site called Jebel El Silsila, which is an ancient quarry.
Right.
And it has about it's not just one quarry, it's several hundred quarries within it. And it's a sandstone quarry where most of the temples of ancient Egypt were kind of birthed from. So there are, I don't know, maybe several hundred temples north to south of Egypt. Yeah. And they all mostly were sourced from this one quarry. And when you go in, you can really, it's like it opens up into a huge cathedral-like space where these, you know, ancient craftsmen, just with copper chisels and wooden mallets, used their skill and ingenuity to hack out huge blocks of stone from the living rock, then dragged them down on sledges to the River Nile, which was, you know, several hundred yards away, put those on boats, and then they got transported away to wherever the pharaoh wanted their latest temple to be built or redesigned or what have you. And those were in use for 1,000 years. So it's kind of crazy.
It?
And so those were like the ordinary folk that were working there.
Right.
You know, your soldiers, your laborers, your stonemasons, and your, you know, so, and we found there, it's under the direction of Lund University in Sweden. Dr. Maria Nilsson is the director. And together with her, we found evidence of ancient villages, one which dates to the reign of Tutankhamun. And I was able to do that from the ceramics that we saw there. I'm the ceramicist for the site, and also his father Akhenaten also had a village, you know, had the same village, and he was building on a monumental scale. He's a really interesting character, actually, Tutankhamun's father Akhenaten, because he moved the capital of Egypt, which was then around Luxor. He moved it to a site called Amarna.
Okay.
And he changed the kind of state religion as well of the of Egypt from what was essentially lots of different gods and goddesses to focusing on one main god called the Aten, which is sort of represented as a solar sun disk. And he totally transformed all of the political structures, all of the key priests and the kind of equivalents of the Archbishop of Canterbury you know, all of those lost their jobs as a result of that.
Why did he do this? What was the reason?
I think it was because he was fed up with them telling him what to do, because they had a lot of sway.
That's a move, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a total move. They had a lot of sway and they knew what they were doing. And I think he was just fed up with all the corruption and the amount of money that they were taking from, you know, to pay for these temples being, you know, being manned, having lots of, they also had their own land. So it's a bit like Henry VIII and the dissolution of the monasteries.
Okay.
Exact same thing. History repeating itself.
Yeah, that's fascinating. We had Ilona Rajulski from the British Museum and Ken Griffin last year. And we both sort of talked to both of them about the idea of Egyptians building large different types of funerary monuments. Alona was saying we have really good information resources on how these things were built, you know, ledgers and things. And Ken was saying, actually, a lot of the times when people say these could only be built by aliens or something similar, it's because it's underland, like, it's there's a racist element to it. The idea that, you know, North Africans wouldn't be able to build these. But you're actually working at one of these sites, and you're showing how they're quarrying and how they're moving large stones and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. You can see the chisel marks. There's a blacksmith area where we know that from all of the copper filings that are littered all around, wow, yeah, that they were there redoing the chisels, because copper is a very soft metal, mm-hmm, and so they probably would have had to have a whole mini industry going that was just like remaking these chisels, mm-hmm, and we can see from the quarry sort of marks and the lines that's where they were cutting the rock, how they were doing it. They were mostly, we think, they used the spoil or the kind of rubble of previous quarrying to make giant ramps up against the rock,
okay,
so that then they could drag your obelisk, say, your large, yeah, larger blocks down off of that. And we can see in some of the tomb scenes that in some cases some of the tomb owners decided to depict some of these scenes of how they dragged,
oh, really? Wow,
the stone. Yes, yeah, there's what some in the tomb of Rekmere in Thebes that show how they dragged a large monumental statue of the king across the land. And from some of our experiments that we've been doing there, they may have used wooden rollers, but what we see in the tomb scenes is that they are on a sledge, a wooden sledge, lashed with rope, and then they seem to have sort of beds of reeds or sort of grasses, mm-hmm, and they're oiling those in front as the sledge is being dragged. So someone's oiling that as they go, and they're dragging and pulling. And it's maybe only 20 men pulling. So they really knew their physics as, mm-hmm, well. They knew exactly what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And they also would have had to have known about ballast weight in boats and, mm-hmm, how that is affected, and, you know, how much wind power that they needed. And so, yes, Ken's absolutely right that to say that they weren't capable of doing that is doing them a massive disservice. Yeah. And we can see that from the quarry.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, thanks for clearing that up. So you've looked, really a lot of your work has been looking at like everyday life.
Yes.
Ancient, from these builders, these guys who worked in the quarry, to the ceramics. I'm going to put you on a spot now. So in all your work, say if we said to you, tomorrow, sir, we want you to start working on an exhibition, and you had to pick one or two pieces to be your key pieces in your museum display.
That's a tough one.
I mean, what would help tell that story? What do you think would be really emblematic of the work that you've done?
So, well, one of the things that I've was very lucky enough to find was a very small little necklace that had obviously been dropped at some point in, you know, in history, and it had fallen onto a little broken ceramic sherd, and it had two little beads of carnelian and a little tiny bit of beaten gold in the middle, and a whole string of beads using a technique called faience, which is kind of a, mm-hmm, step between glass and pottery. Mm-hmm. So that to me speaks to, and it was sort of curled up as well. And so that sort of little human moment, like we've all done it, we've all dropped something, yep, and forgotten where it's gone. That would be one of my main ones, because it was right in the middle of a kitchen, mm-hmm, with ovens everywhere and ash and dust, and someone had just, yeah, forgotten it. So that would be one piece. Mm-hmm. I'd probably also want to recreate a potter's workshop, because there's a few that we know from, especially at Amarna, so from Akhenaten's, mm-hmm, city, there's a few that have been excavated. And that as well, to me, So you'd have the potter's wheel, the clay supplies, the bench that they worked at, the water supply. So mm-hmm. exactly how it would be.
Yeah, the whole setup.
The whole setup as it would, as a modern potter would have it. So that to me would showcase your daily life. And then maybe also things like granaries, so where they would store mm-hmm. their wheat and barley. The sort of farmyard work processing areas, because mm-hmm. that again also would show your daily life. So almost everybody would have had their own at least land to access or work. Mm-hmm. Or they might have been, they're often kind of like serfs as part of a bigger estate, but they would all have their own land to work. I would sort of showcase that as mm-hmm. well, and maybe have a scratch plow to show like how it was pulled by oxen mm-hmm. and sort of to reconstruct your sort of average scenes mm-hmm. that that we know existed. These kind of cottage industries that aren't really spoken about so much, because you see in most exhibitions are your gold,
yes.
your big pharaoh names, sarcophagus, yeah. your mummies, your big pharaoh names that everybody has heard of, Ramses, Tutankhamun, you know, those big mm-hmm. superstars, yeah. if you like. But there's so much more to Egypt than just those people, because Tutankhamun reigned for, like, he was 18 when he died, you know, so he reigned six years. Mm-hmm. And it's only because, and he was a really minor king, relatively mm-hmm. speaking, but it's just because Howard Carter in 1922 found his tomb intact mm-hmm. because it was underneath the rubble of the excavations of a later king mm-hmm. and it was lost. If we had found some of the big name pharaohs, like Ramses II's tomb, that would have been unreal.
Yeah.
But his was he's a minor king. Most of his stuff came from random people's items that then they added his name to. A lot of them are his father's objects.
Oh, so from other tombs?
Other tombs.
Yeah, okay.
Because he died so young, way before he was supposed to. There's a lot of debate still how he died or why. Mm-hmm. But certainly he was quite a sickly person in life, it seems. So for me, it's your ordinary folk.
Yep.
I want to tell their stories.
Well, I'm with you. When we put exhibitions on in the museum, I mean, personally, I'm not that interested or only slightly interested in what the managing director did. You want to know what life was like in the mill or in the workshop day to day. I think it speaks more to our own experiences.
Absolutely.
I think it's really interesting and kind of crucial that we get to that, the exhibition. So that's fascinating. So last year we had the British Museum touring exhibition, mm-hmm. Egyptian Hieroglyphs, Unlock the Mystery. It's the full title, you have to give it every time.
Of course.
Yep. And so it was all about decipherment. And it was fascinating. You know, we got to delve deep into decipherment and what difference it made. So what about your own work? I mean, what did decipherment mean? Or what does it mean for the work you do now? Do you have to engage with it? Is hieroglyphs part of the work that you have to undertake day to day?
Well, I have to admit, I was never hugely great at hieroglyphs in university. So I do use it in terms of sort of translating basic translations, mm-hmm. or I would use it for translating letters. I would use hieratic more, which is a sort of shorthand version of hieroglyphs, which a lot of papyrus was written in rather than hieroglyphs as such. So I'm more interested in the letters between people. So at the Tomb Builders Village, for example, called Deir el-Medina on the west bank of Thebes, mm-hmm. Most of the people there, around 80%, were literate, and they all wrote letters, mm-hmm. or lots of them wrote letters, and 14% of them were women who were writing, and that's really interesting
to
me.
Was that the big find at the end of the 19th century? Is that?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
I think Ken was talking about
that. Yeah, Ken loves Deir el-Medina as well, so I'm sure he.
Yeah.
In my talk this evening, I'll showcase some of the letters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of them are gossiping. She did this to me, or and right. he's not returned this to me. I want more ointment for my eyes.
Okay.
Why haven't you done my laundry on time? Where are you? Yeah. Why haven't you helped me out? It's exactly what we would do now on our WhatsApp messages.
Yeah, okay.
So I like that.
Yeah, that's, you know, brilliant. Yeah.
Rather than your big proclamations that you would get on your hieroglyphs.
They're a bit dry and not as quite as interesting.
Yeah, and I don't love all the pyramid text hymns. I find them also slightly,
a
little bit duller. I'm not so interested in that, I have to say.
That's fascinating. So what's next then for you?
Well, I'm teaching at the Egypt Exploration Society. So I start a 5-week course in a couple of weeks called Taste of Egypt, where I sort of use my interest in kind of culinary skills and cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to teach all about that, and I'll also I want the students to have a go recreating some ancient recipes.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at how they bake bread, sort of sweet what desserts they had. I'll have a bread week, and I'm also trying to extract ancient yeast or yeast from the air and showcase how you would do that.
Really?
Wow. Or alternatively, you can use your sourdough starters that you've maybe kept going from lockdown.
Yeah.
You know, so things like that. So and I'll also be teaching an Egyptian technology course at the University of Oxford in April. So, and they're all online, and people can engage with me
whenever
they like. So that's how I like to do it, because I want to be as accessible as possible.
And,
really.
And then are you back excavating? Are you...
Yes, I hope to be working back at Jebel Silsila in the near future. We're fundraising at the moment. Mm-hmm. We found a lot of tombs in the last few seasons, and we're hoping to get them properly secured and also to help fund our work with the local Egyptian workers.
Mm-hmm.
So we're fundraising for that currently, so fingers crossed we'll get to go there soon. But otherwise, I'm working a lot in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia and Oman, so hopefully I'll mm-hmm. be going there soon to do some more surveying.
Brilliant.
So, yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much.